on weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
And a big thank you to the two Johnnies. You are very welcome to Game On. It's Tuesday, October 3rd. Joining us today, Mark Langdon and Paul Curry will set us up for match day 2 of the Champions League as Erik ten Hag goes in search of what is a badly needed win for Manchester United.
I hope he can find it. I hope he can find it. In rugby, Peter Wright will give us the view from Scotland ahead of what is really the first crucial World Cup week for Ireland.
And we will have all the day's news, and we are looking to do it in the company of your views. You can text us. Our number is 51552. You can tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
How are you, Ruby?
I'm great, Damien. Yourself?
Not a bother. Alive and well for a... I'm at that stage of the week where I'm already not sure what day of the week it is, which is always a bad way to be. Thank God the man who produces this programme puts it on the top of the running order, so it's not too bad. Listen, I was going to say you survived Paris. You were working hard in Paris over the weekend, so good weekend at the Prix de l'Arc?
Doing a little bit, yeah. I had a great weekend at the Prix de l'Arc. It was my first time. I was actually at a Prix de l'Arc, Damien. I'm usually in Tipperary, but I managed to get to Paris this year, and it was a brilliant weekend. Longchamp was a great place to go racing. So compact, great atmosphere, great buzz. The Prix de l'Arc was a great race. Obviously, Ace Impact won it, beat West over the English horse, and Onesta was third, but it was a really enjoyable weekend, so it was.
It's actually a brilliant place. If you're into racing, it's a great place to go because, despite the scale of Paris, it's really accessible. It's relatively central. Like, you know, I have known one or two people have gone to Paris for the weekend, have left the significant other, be they male or female, in the hotel, have gone off and enjoyed themselves, and you're back in Paris city centre in no time at all.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, into the Bois de Boulogne, obviously I've been in Auteuil loads of times, which is on the west side. Longchamp's on the east side. But it was a great weekend. Paris is always a beautiful place to go. And contrary to most people's opinion, I didn't find it that dear.
You're not going near the tourist traps. You know, you'd run a mile from those lads selling plastic Eiffel Towers and stuff. You know, you'd be looking for the authentic corner shop, you know.
I went into a corner shop and bought 2 cans of Coke, which I badly needed on Sunday morning, a can of San Pellegrino and 2 bottles of water for €5.20. And the lady behind the counter, I was looking at her in amazement, kind of thought that she thought I thought I was being robbed. And it was the other way around. I thought she'd missed half the items.
Whereas, yeah, you wouldn't get that for €15 here. So
I didn't think I would. It was an enjoyable weekend. The racing was good as well. Obviously, one Irish winner in Opera Singer for Aidan O'Brien won the Prix Marcel Boussac under Ryan Moore. And she looked a bit exceptional, Damien, so she did. She was very, very impressive. Rosalie and won the Jean-Luc Lacadère for Sean Levy, another Irish jockey, and Richard Hannon. Ace Impact was the French winner of the Prix de l'Arc. Blue Rose Seine won the Prix de l'Opera. And then you had Highfield Princess winning the Prix de l'Abbé. And Frankie didn't quite get the send-off he was looking for on Kinross. He only finished second behind Kalina. But all in all, it was a really good day.
This is now the longest farewell. Like, people were taking the mick out of... I think Elton John has played Dublin on 3 occasions in his farewell tour. Frankie's starting to feel that little... I wonder, like, even he himself now must be embarrassed at the final this, the final that, the final everything else.
About embarrassed. There's 2 ways of looking at it, Damien. I know I wouldn't have been able to do it. Mm. Personally, I couldn't have. The attention, the circus that's around it, it wouldn't have been for me. I couldn't do that. Frankie does enjoy the publicity, I suppose, but the other side, obviously, he has brought plenty of publicity to meetings that could do with it.
Yeah, and people through the gates.
People through the gates. So, to be fair to him, he probably is adding to the sport. It is... I'm sure for racing people, it feels like a very long goodbye. And even if you're saying so, Damien, it must feel an extra long goodbye.
I'm struggling with how many meetings even we've done on the radio or how many times on bulletins you're talking about his final this, his final that, his final whatever else. And like at the centre of it, like you've touched upon, he must have a pain in his... Well, no, he probably doesn't. I would have a pain in my backside answering constant questions about... Are you emotional about your last Prix de l'Arc? Are you emotional about your last Irish Champions weekend? Are you emotional about your, you know, but maybe that's just...
They're all the questions I asked him when we had him on here a few weeks ago.
He answered them to you.
The pressure, Damien, I don't know. Everyone looking at you, the expectation, it's... And that is what the rugby players will feel this weekend. It's the pressure of expectation. Mm. That's the greatest pressure that there is. And Frankie has brought a lot of expectation on himself.
Would you know that the Rugby World Cup is on from being in Paris?
Yes, especially when you drive down the Seine and you see the big, what looked like the fan zone to me. It sticks out like a sore thumb, but you would. And Yeah, look, it was a wonderful weekend. Obviously, there was no rugby in Paris last weekend. It was all around the country, but it comes back to Paris from this weekend, Damien, and it doesn't leave again.
Yeah, there's a little bit of criticism, and I can understand it, that like the first weekend was like a bumper weekend of fixtures. Second weekend wasn't quite as good. You had Ireland, South Africa then, but like the weekend just gone, it's very hard to get an awful lot of interest in. And now, listen, I understand the scale of it. They're obviously talking now about expanding the tournament, which ironically would actually make it shorter, because it does kind of drift in and out of your life if you're not intensely focused on it.
I suppose when you look at it though, you can't play a rugby match, or the same players can't play it as often as you can soccer matches, because of the physicality of the game. So I can understand why they need to have a minimum of 5 and preferably 7 days between games. Is there too many teams in it and they're looking to add in more? I don't know, do you go with a preliminary World Cup, a bit like the T20? Is there a Super 8 and then you've qualification to get into that? Maybe that'd be a better way of doing it if you're trying to give Tier 2 nations a chance. But it is a bit drawn out. But look, I'd say, providing Ireland aren't leaving France this weekend, Damien, we'll have a lot to look forward to next weekend.
So listen, you missed Man United's result over the weekend, obviously because you were working hard. Did you get an opportunity?
Could you miss that?
Well, Paul is with us. We'll chat about that and more in a second. Did you follow the Ryder Cup?
Yes, it was brilliant, wasn't it? Saturday night was the making of it. Rory losing it, Shane coming to the rescue to put him in the car. It just added the spice that it needed. And he was like the big brother, wasn't he? Mm. Just guide him, like a fellow outside a nightclub, his brother into the car.
But listen, the bit that I love most about it was, get away from him, Rory, he's not worth it, get into the car. And then he turned around to get stuck into him afterwards.
That's typical. I was looking at it laughing because my younger brother is considerably bigger than me, so he has often moved me out of somewhere and then turned around to stand his ground, and I was laughing as Shane Lowry looked like he was doing the same thing.
You know, the bit that I really enjoyed was, like, McIlroy got so emotional on Sunday, and he was asked, like, directly coming off the green after finishing his match, was asked about Saturday night. I love the fact that he is so great at giving an honest answer to an honest question. Were you riled up? How much did last night impact on you? And it was like, yeah, I was riled up. Yes, it did give me the extra motivation, rather than this thing of, oh, it was a flashpoint and we've kissed and made up and we've, you know.
But it's the same as criticism. And there's two ways you can take criticism, public or media criticism. I always took it in that I'll prove you're wrong.
Yeah.
So there's two ways you can take criticism. You can let it hurt you and offend you, or you can go the other way and say, I'll prove you're wrong and I'll be back tomorrow. And that's the way Rory McIlroy took it.
Listen, who'd have thought they could turn golf into, like, it was like the Royal Rumble in wrestling. It was
brilliant, wasn't it?
You know?
And even on the golf on Sunday, Rahm getting the half on 18, Victor Hovland doing what he does, Rory 3-1, Tyrrell Hatton 3-2, and then obviously Ricky Fowler, which I thought at the end of it all was so sporting, gave him the putt. It was over. Some people are saying, oh, you should have made him putt it. Like, Ricky Fowler was realistic.
Yeah,
it was over.
What's the point?
Just take it away.
Like I said to somebody at the weekend, I haven't felt so European since they made us re-vote on the Nice Treaty. You know, it's like that.
Were you old enough to vote then?
Listen, if I was, you were. Right, let's get stuck into the soccer. Paul Curry is with us in studio. It kind of feels ludicrous, Paul, that here we are on the second weekend, or the second round of games in the Champions League, and we're talking about this being a must-win match for Man United against Galatasaray tonight.
It feels like something needs to shift in from a momentum perspective, from a Manchester United point of view. I mean, they've been really poor in the league. The fact that they've only scored 7 goals gives you an idea of how bad they have been going forward. And then you look at the team and the team that played Crystal Palace on the weekend, it just feels like there's no balance at all in the middle of the park. I mean, we'll talk about it until they change it, but Casemiro, Mount and Fernandes will not track back. They will not fill defensive positions, and it just leaves Casemiro with so much work to do. And if you look at Casemiro from last season to now, it looks as if he's kind of gone into reverse, and the legs are starting to get heavier and the years are starting to tell. I think the last point on that, Damien, as well, is in around Lisandro Martinez. Like, he's out for 2 to 3 months now. That's a major, major blow for them. If you think about last year, the defensive, they were really good. Varane and Martinez had a very good partnership, and defensively they were one of the best teams in the league. Now they look a shambles. The fact that Amrabat was playing left back on the weekend, with all the money that's been put into that squad, you would beg belief where that money has gone and where the players are based on the monies that they've spent. So it feels like a big game. There's obviously been talk about the Glazers potentially selling a percentage stake in the club. I think that's kind of masking over the performances and results in recent weeks. It hasn't been good enough. And for Ten Hag, you know, you need to start winning games. And if they were to go out of this Champions League group, that would really sound alarm bells, I think.
But Paul, whatever about Mount and Fernandez not tracking back, Casemiro's having to do it. Casemiro's also their leading goal scorer in all competitions. So like, if you're not going to come back, at least be doing something going forward. What's going wrong at that end of the pitch?
Well, I think, you know, they've had a couple of chances and they've created a small bit, Ruby, within games, and any chances that they have had, whether it's been Rashford or Hoyland or Pelestri or Martial when he's come off the bench, they just have not found any sort of form in front to go. And to that point as well, they haven't found the same sort of rhythm. If you think back to Rashford when he came back from the World Cup, he couldn't miss. Anything he hit just seemed to hit the back of the net. Now it is a completely different perspective. It seems in games as well that they tend to be going behind. Teams are then playing a low block and they just have no sort of ideas of how to craft an opportunity, how to get in behind back fours, and they run out of ideas. And I think that would be a big worry if I was a Manchester United fan, that they don't seem to have the same sort of confidence nor rhythm when they're finding the final third. And the likes of Fernandes and Rashford, who were so good for them last year, seem as if they seem to be really struggling with confidence. And Hoyland, like, I almost feel for him. Like, he's been brought in, you know, they spent a lot of money, but this guy hasn't played a huge amount of games in Italy. He's not played a huge games now in the Premier League, and there's a lot of pressure on his shoulders to produce.
We're going to chat to Mark Langdon, who's with us as well, in just a moment. But before that, we talked about Erik ten Hag, and you could question, like, tactically things on the field, players that he has available to him. Then there's other issues that are within his control, like the Jadon Sancho situation appears to have brought so much pressure upon himself. And no doubt when you're a manager in a situation like this, you want big figures within the club's history or big figures within the game to step forward and buy you a bit of time. That hasn't been the case. Step forward, Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
The new coach came from where?
Ajax.
I was in Ajax also. Ajax is a talented club. Mm. They have the best talents in the club. They don't have big stars. Mm. What is the experience of this coach? Mm. Young talents. He comes to United. United is different mentality, different players. Mm. So the players there supposed to be big stars. You manage talents, upgrowing, is different kind of approach, because there you have a different kind of discipline. You come to United, you do the same thing. I don't know, I don't believe, and I don't think it's the same treatment you give. I don't say it's the coach's fault, because experience you cannot buy. Mm. You just have to get time to get the experience. But it's two different situations, being in Ajax, being in United. Then if it's his fault, I don't think, because I think everybody has a responsible in the whole situation. We are a piece of puzzle from the big puzzle. Mm. So everybody have a responsibility to do and to fulfill the demands. United has to win. They have to win every title they play for. Now they're being dominating by the neighbors, and it's a totally different situation there.
Do you think he's out of his depth a bit, Ten Hag?
I think he needs more time to get the experience, how to handle a team.
But you don't really get time at a club like United.
No, obviously not, because we need to win.
That's the reality.
You come to when I was in Milan, I cannot give you time to develop, to perform. You need to perform straight, because like I said, survival mode. Mm. It's you or another one, because United is in a situation, you don't do good enough, the next day there is another one. Mm. And the result speaks for itself. So that's why it's tricky. But how much time do you give a coach? I don't know. Depends on the owners, what they want. Mm. But if you listen to the fans, you don't have a lot of time, because they want to win.
Well, Zlatan doesn't know how much time Erik ten Hag has. Mark Langdon, how long do you think he has?
I mean, I think I don't feel like he's sort of that close to being sacked at the moment. I mean, it's interesting listening to Ibrahimovic there and talking about experience of big players. But United have had that. They had that with Van Gaal. They had that with Mourinho, and that didn't really work either. Certainly not over a sustained period. So it feels like it's not just the manager and his lack of experience in managing big stars that is the problem. It's not been a good start to the season, and you know, if maybe it carried on for the whole season, then maybe United would have to look at it. But I think they're a long way from thinking that Ten Hag is, you know, the only problem at United. I mean, it would be one issue you could solve by just sacking him, but you'd only create another one by, you know, would you really trust that whoever's making the decisions at United to bring in somebody better than him? A lot of the decisions they've got sort of on the football side of things over, probably the last decade have not been right. So, I'm not saying Ten Hag is the absolute answer for United, but he's certainly not the problem either, I don't think.
But Mark, like, it just, we keep coming back to the same point. It's like, you know, the fish rots from the head, that the problem is the entire culture of the club from management level, and until that is rectified, Manchester United fans just need to look at other clubs that have fallen by the wayside and accept that that is likely to be the future for the foreseeable number of years.
Yeah, I think that the ownership is, you know, a clear issue. Not, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the different arguments in terms of how much money they're putting in, how much money they're taking out, but the lack of sort of care that they've got over whether the team is successful or not, I think that the biggest problem that they've got, you know, the sort of the sporting directors or that they've had, and, you know, just when they have appointed one, it's not really been with a clear vision in mind. You know, this squad is a mixture of players bought by you know, different coaches, and I think that's maybe an area where I would blame Ten Hag, in that, you know, he's quite narrow-minded in the type of player that he's wanted, and a lot of those he's worked with before, and that does feel, you know, not the smartest approach in sort of 2023, when there's all this data out there. You know, you're seeing teams be much smarter maybe than Manchester United in the transfer market. But, you know, I saw sort of videos of the kind of, you know, holes in the roof at Old Trafford on Saturday. I mean, that's, yeah, again, that doesn't affect the performances sort of on the pitch, sort of in many aspects, but just shows how little care the owners actually have in the club. And I think that just does become a cultural problem from top to bottom.
It looks like it most certainly is, and it's going to be a quick fix. But anyway, Manchester United are not the only English team playing in the Champions League tonight, because Paul Curry, Arsenal have gone to Lens, and they've been out of the Champions League for 21 years, and it's a tough place to go.
Yeah, it will be a tough game. I mean, naturally enough, when you go away in the Champions League, if you can pick up 3 points, you tend to be happy. But Lens really are really struggling in Ligue 1 at the moment, sitting in 15th. They've played 7 games, they've only won 2 of them. So you would expect, given the start to the season that Arsenal have had, and given the start to the group that they had in week one when they won 4-0 against PSV, you would expect that with the confidence in that team and just the attacking threats that they have, that they should have too much for them. Saka looks like he's going to miss out tonight. Gabriel Martinelli's another injury that they've picked up in recent weeks. It'll be interesting to see how they sort of balance that out. Gabriel Jesus has played from the left with Nketiah through the middle. Can they kind of replicate the same sort of attacking threat, the same goals and goal involvements that Martinelli and Saka can do? I'm not so sure. So if they were to be kind of two players who were to be out for the next couple of weeks, that would be a huge, huge loss for Arsenal. But I wouldn't expect I would have too many troubles tonight against Lens. In general, it's a pretty easy group, and you would expect it's one that Arsenal will top.
And it's about Arsenal getting the business done early. But, you know, like, I know it sounds simplistic, but just do what you need to do to advance.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, they're having to balance Champions League football this year, and they're going to need a greater strength and depth within the squad. And that is something that is going to test them a hell of a lot more than it did last year, where they were, yes, in the Europa League, but they were kind of blooding a lot of players who weren't playing in the Premier League in the big games. So that will be a test to the squad, and Arteta, how he balances that and whether or not they can keep up with Man City. But yeah, it's about getting the job done early if you can. And if you hit like kind of 45 minutes, you would look to kind of bring off some of those players, which I'm sure when he reflects the game of the weekend against Bournemouth, I'd say he wishes he took the likes of Saka off, because you need to protect those big players,
particularly when you're comfortably in control of the game. Mark, in footballing terms, how do you assess the challenges both English teams face tonight?
I would say, you know, from United's point of view, they should beat Galatasaray at home. Galatasaray have struggled in the Champions League for a number of years now, and, you know, are not kind of, you remember sort of the welcome to hell stuff of, what was that, it feels about sort of 20 years ago or whatever it is. I mean, the team just, you know, Turkish football's fallen behind some of the biggest leagues. They've got a lot of kind of names that people will be familiar with: Icardi, Mertens, Ziyech, who's been struggling with injury, Zaha, of course, and Ndombele and Sanchez from Tottenham. Lucas Torreira used to play for Arsenal as well. So sort of familiar names, but most of those have probably seen better days, I think it's fair to say. The problem is just United. You know, United just haven't played well enough to trust to win any game, really, at the moment. But I think that this is one that they should be capable of winning. In terms of Arsenal, I would just say with Lons that they started the season really poorly. They lost their two best players, the top scorer, Appenda, who went to Leipzig, and Fofana, the midfielder, went to a Saudi Arabian club. And they did start slowly, and even in the Champions League on match day one, really poor opening against Sevilla. They battled back to get a draw in that game, and their form has started to turn sort of back towards what they did last season. So a game Arsenal, I think, on paper would expect to win, but I would just throw out a bit of caution there that Lons are improving after a bad start.
There are, of course, two games underway in the Champions League already, where Union Berlin are 1-0 up against Braga after 37 minutes, and Salzburg are two goals behind to Real Sociedad after 39 minutes. But, Paul, when I looked through the games this morning, the one that jumped off me that it looks a standout game, it's Napoli and Real Madrid, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Napoli was a team who was a little disappointed in last year when they got knocked out because there was so much promise of how strong they were in Serie A, and they've started the Serie A season in similar kind of form. There was obviously a lot of talk around Osimhen and the debacle they had with the social media campaign and what they put out, but he's bounced back really well and he's gone back to back scoring. So you would expect to be a really open type game. Napoli tend to play that kind of possession style football and look to break teams down, and we all know about the threats that Real Madrid have, and in particular, I mean, a lot of eyes are on Jude Bellingham and the performances that he's shown in recent weeks. So it should be one that should be a real good game to watch. Superbly open, you would imagine, and both teams have so much threat going forward. So yeah, a real, I guess, game that you would be looking to tune into. And I guess when you look at that group as well, Ruby, it's the results against each other that will determine who's going to top that group. You wouldn't expect that Union Berlin nor Braga would be able to cope with kind of the powerhouses that are Napoli and Real Madrid.
I wouldn't have thought so either. But Mark, when you look at both Napoli and Real, Napoli scored 8 goals when they beat Udinese and Lecce in the last two games. Real have won 7 of their first 8 fixtures in the La Liga. Will this be a tight scoreless game, or will these teams go at each other?
I think generally speaking, Napoli, you know, certainly under the previous coach Spalletti, used to go at teams, you know, just relentlessly. I think Rudy Garcia, the new coach, is more methodical in his approach, but their best players are in the final third. So it would make sense for them to go at Real Madrid. Real Madrid have been a funny side this season, picked up a lot of wins. Most of them have come late on in matches, usually through Jude Bellingham. And whenever I watch Real Madrid, most of the time I'm thinking, you know, I don't know how they win as many games as they do, because it's not like that kind of Man City style dominant of teams. They just seem to wake up in moments, and you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of weren't maybe playing as good a football as Napoli tonight, but then in just big moments, sort of, you know, in the box, somebody like Bellingham just decides the game, because it feels like it's gone on too long for it to be a fluke how Real Madrid kind of get their wins in the Champions League. But time after time, I am left sort of scratching my head thinking they haven't even dominated that game, but they just come up sort of big in those key moments. I heard you mention there about the Sociedad game. If you do get a chance to check out the goal from Mendes, the second goal in this game against Salzburg, absolutely wonderful. Picks the ball up inside his own half and eventually finishes the shot off without passing to anybody. So the defending wasn't amazing, but it was still a great run and great finish.
Mark, just on Madrid, there's obviously so much scrutiny on what the managerial... I know it's ludicrous to be talking about the managerial situation for next season when we're only a couple of games into this season, but these rumours about Xavi Alonso leaving Leverkusen to go to Madrid aren't going away. And you look at the job he's doing there in what's a relatively fledgling managerial career. He certainly looks to have the ability. You'd wonder, does he have the status yet to take on the Galacticos?
I think he does have, probably because of his kudos in terms of what he did as a player. You know, one of those, you know, of course, being with Real Madrid. The work he's done at Leverkusen is fantastic. This was a team that was really struggling, probably in a false position in the Bundesliga when he picked up the job, but just been absolutely, you know, what you'd expect of a Xabi Alonso team, you know, winning matches, but doing it in a style that he would you know, want them to do it in. He's somebody that's played under some absolute legends of the game, including Pep Guardiola and Jose Mourinho. So he's got a clash of styles there. He's brought on, he's not quite in that kind of Pep, everything's got to be possession based. So I think he probably has taken on one or two things from Mourinho as well. I think his time.
And with that, Mark disappears.
Probably going to
oh, he's
be.
Back.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say that it seems like, I think from Ancelotti's point of view, this might be his last season. And Xabi Alonso is timing his run absolutely perfectly to sort of put himself in prime position. Another candidate's been mentioned is Raul, who's managing the sort of the youth teams at Real Madrid. But, you know, Alonso is doing it at a much higher level. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he got a bigger job next season, and you can see how that Real Madrid one kind of works with him timing his run just absolutely to perfection.
Carlo Ancelotti has named his team. Paul, are you impressed with who he's picked?
I am. I'll just run through very quickly, Ruby. Kepa in goal, Carvajal, Bellingham, Nacho, Vinicius Jr., Cruz, Rodrigo, Camavinga, Valverde, Tchouameni and Rudiger. I mean, the what stands out for me there is the fact that Rodrigo, Vinicius Jr. and Bellingham are all playing together. I think it's probably the first time this season Hosslu has been leading up front, and that's not really the same sort of firepower as you get with those three. And I think if that front three could click, that could be a bit of a difference. Just touching on Mark's point, that could give them a hell of a lot more going forward, and that is certainly a front three to look out for, and it could, like, when you put it against the best in Europe, it's certainly up there.
Mark, Copenhagen got draws last year against Sevilla, Borussia Dortmund and Man City. Can they get one against Bayern Munich this time round?
I wouldn't have thought so. They threw away 3 points against Galatasaray on match day one. They were 2-0 up and then got reduced to 10 men. But, you know, Bayern Munich had to come from two down themselves against Leipzig at the weekend. They're scoring a lot of goals. Obviously, Harry Kane's been in good nick for them. I think when it comes to sort of semi-finals, final, quarter-finals, that defence that Bayern have got could get found out. They just concede too many goals for my liking at the very highest level. Tonight's game against Copenhagen isn't at that level, so should be okay to win the game.
Mark, to finish and to go back to where we started, Manchester United Galatasaray tonight, obviously there's a lot of focus on Wilfried Zaha in advance of the game. We'll chat about him in a minute, but he was asked probably on more than one occasion to reflect on his time at United.
When you look at my face, do you think I'm bothered at all? No. Realistically, I think I went through a phase where you either build from it or you die out from it. And me personally, I was never going to die out from it. So it built my character for me to just continue in my career, because I was determined to not let my career die out because I went somewhere and it didn't work out. I was just determined to reach where I wanted to reach. And yeah, I'm here today, here.
I was reading back over stuff today, Mark, and, you know, like, obviously left Crystal Palace as, like, the next massive star of English football, had obviously played underage, had a couple of caps. The United thing, it's probably unfair to say it derailed his career, but the amount of focus he had to endure, had to come out and deny these rumours about himself and David Moyes' daughter, which Patrice Evra then poured further petrol on, like, you look at it as a junction in the road and where his career ended up going compared to where it might have been when he went to United with such enthusiasm and expectation.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, that's one of the reasons he's gone to Galatasaray to play, and he references it there, to play in the Champions League, because, you know, it was a stage where he felt like he belonged and it didn't work out for him. I suppose you can look at it two ways. I mean, I think I prefer to go that it's really difficult to be a Premier League footballer, you know, almost impossible dream, and how many people try to do it. And he still managed it. And yeah, it didn't work out at Manchester United, but he's had a great career at Crystal Palace, and now he is playing in the Champions League. So it kind of derailed him for a little while. And maybe if it would have worked out at Manchester United, you know, he could have become the superstar player that maybe people tipped him to be. But I mean, he still had a great career, and you know, the Crystal Palace fans loved him. He's he's still been, you know, influential in the Premier League. And, you know, Manchester United, not the only player, I'd say, Zaha, to fail, in inverted commas, at Manchester United. And that does bring it back to how we started this conversation with it just not being a great environment. And it hasn't been for a long time.
It is a bit disappointing. Paul Curry, there is Premier League action this evening as well. Luton are playing Burnley. Luton fresh from a 2-1 win over Everton at the weekend. Burnley won from bottom. How do you see that one going?
What a cracker this one is.
Oh, it's riveting stuff. It could be a huge one, though, come the end of the season goes down.
Oh, ye of little faith. There could be Irish players aplenty here now tonight. This could be about as exciting as it gets for us from an Irish perspective.
I'm just looking. Josh Cullen is certainly starting. I can't really see anybody else. No, it doesn't look like any other Irish involvement. I mean, Luton were pretty impressive on the weekend. I was listening to Rob Edwards, and he was giving out that so many of the people around the game have kind of already relegated them without giving them a bit of time to adjust to the Premier League. They were good against Everton. I think if you're looking at Luton and their survival, these are the types of games, the likes of Everton and Burnley, where they're going to have to pick up points, particularly when they're at home. And for Vincent Kompany and his Burnley side, they certainly need to find a performance and a result pretty quickly, because you don't want to allow that gap to increase between yourselves and safety. So I hate to be boring, but I think it's going to be a draw. And I kind of hope it is, because Chelsea played Burnley on the weekend, so I wouldn't want to see them gathering any sort of momentum before then.
Lovely.
We're very parochial. Mark, we're going to chat about...
Sorry, Ogbene is starting as well.
Ah, there you go. Mark, we're going to chat in greater detail towards the end of the programme about VAR and the situation over the weekend. Overall, what's your assessment of what played out at the... No, sorry, you're completely biased in all this, as am I, on the other side of the fence. So what's your neutral perspective on what played out at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium on Saturday?
Yes, I am a Spurs fan. I was in the stadium, and it's always a bonkers... you know, being in the stadium, having sort of no TV or, you know, no real sense of what's going on. So I didn't even realise there was any injustice until probably 45 minutes after the game. So from that point of view, you know, the in sort of stadium experience remains horrendous for the match-going supporter. I've never been a huge fan of VAR, and I've seen various mistakes throughout Europe. I mean, a Portuguese game where they couldn't get an offside because the post in the stand was blocking the view that they wanted. I remember an Italian game involving Juventus where they didn't spot that a defender was sort of near the corner flag and thought that the attacking team, Juventus in this case, were offside. So it's not only in the Premier League where things have gone wrong. I think that trying to find perfection is impossible. Just on that incident, though, I do believe that if they found out within seconds, they should have been able to have gone back and rectified the mistake. I know that the protocol would have been wrong, but it would have been the right thing to do. And I actually think there would have been less fuss made about that. So I think in that incident, I also believe that the process is wrong in terms of that you just say check complete. I mean, surely you have to say check complete, it's a goal, check complete, no goal. I mean, that to me just feels like an absolutely obvious thing to have to say. And I didn't even know that they didn't say that, but hopefully they will in future.
The fine folk in the Premier League, to their credit, have released the audio exchange which took place. So, gentlemen, sit back, relax and enjoy a minute 44 seconds of chaos.
Oh, good. Both holding.
Yeah. Leave it alone.
Waiting. Delay in.
Yes.
Give it.
Pull it back for the offside, mate.
Just checking the offside, delay. Give me kick point. Let's go. Yep. Kick point,
yeah,
please.
No worries,
mate. So, here we are.
Okay. Wait, okay.
Just get a tight angle.
Yeah, give me 2D line ready, I feel, as well, for frame
right,
two.
So
that's
frame,
fine.
Frame two, down.
Perfect.
I've got the table, like
2D line on left boot.
Yep. Let me just switch angles. I think it might be this angle better. Happy with this angle?
You're good eyes, you, Dominic.
2D line on the boot.
2D line on the boot.
Yep, okay.
Wait.
So 2D line on the boot. I'll zoom
check
in.
Complete. It's fine. Perfect.
Yeah. Off.
Thank you, mate.
Wait. The on-field decision was offside. Are you happy with this?
Yeah.
Are you happy with this?
Offside field is a goal. Yeah. That's what it does.
What?
On-field decision was offside. Are you happy with this image? Yeah, it's onside. The image we gave you is onside.
Left back. He's played. He's gone offside.
Did I delay, delay, delay. They're only saying to delay.
Pardon?
Ollie's calling in to say delay the game. To complete. The decision is offside.
Can't do anything.
Ollie's saying to delay. Ollie's saying to delay.
Ollie?
Yeah.
Delay the game. To delay the game. Stop the game.
They've restarted
nothing
the game.
They've restarted.
Can't do anything.
No.
I can't do anything. I can't do anything.
Firstly, it sounds like the moon landing. Secondly, like that doesn't do anything, Paul, to instill faith in you in how this entire operation works.
No, it doesn't, and it's hard to believe that once the game restarts, you can't pull it back for something as prominent and as important as a goal within a game. Like, it wasn't as if we were kind of 30 seconds down. It restart the game before they were able to pick it up. I'm not really too sure at the same time, Damien, how much good that does, releasing that audio. Like, what's the need for that?
Well,
does it help?
The thing that jumps out at me, Mark, is like the realizations. Now, that's the first time we have all heard that, because it's only been released a short time ago. Like, they seem to realize very quickly, hang on a second, we've backed the wrong horse here and we're wrong. But yes, surely, like Paul is saying, there has to be some flexibility in a situation like that for the guy to say, sorry.
Oh, lads, that's comical, come on.
No, but
it is.
Well, it is comical, but it shouldn't be. But like surely they have to realize, hang on a second, we're answering a different question than the one we were asked, and there has to be a way of stopping it and rectifying it.
I can't stop laughing.
Because you're a United fan.
No, I'm not. It's not even a United fan. I mean, that's like something from, I don't know where, Mars or something. But does that not, this is my opinion, is that nobody's in charge? Nobody was able to make the call. Who's Ollie? Ollie's not even in the tent with them, or in the van or wherever they are. That's what it sounded like to me, Mark. There's nobody in charge there.
No, there isn't. And I think this all comes down to the on-field referee supposed to have the final decision. And you're right. Like, I think maybe who is supposed to be in charge there? There were too many voices. I mean, it shouldn't be that difficult to have somebody check the offside. I also think that in trying to speed up the whole process, they have rushed through too many things. Now, if you remember last year, Brentford scored a goal against Arsenal that shouldn't have been given. That was on a technicality that they hadn't gone through the process. And it's this panic. It always panic to they want the game to be restarted. But then that comes down to the whole point of VAR in the first place. If you're going down the VAR route, you are going to take so much away from football by having it. You have to then give yourself the time to make the right decisions. And, that just, it was a mess from beginning to end. It's not a good look. But they had to release it. Liverpool wanted the audio out there. So, I mean, I suppose we've all made mistakes before, and you wouldn't always want them broadcasted everywhere, but that's the way it is.
That's like good old fashioned English comedy, though, that is.
Yeah, but listen, the problem now is they've crossed the Rubicon in terms of releasing the audio of what are now contentious decisions, because if something happens next week, whatever club it is completely entitled to say, well, hang on a second, you released the audio for Liverpool, you need to release the audio for this. Myself and Paul were chatting off air that, like, this is clearly not working to the optimum. But is there a tipping point at which an event so significant, Mark, is going to happen that they're going to have to say, we need to scrap this and we need to come up with a completely different system? Because it appears like a blind man would see that the system that's in place at the minute is not working.
Yeah, I tend to think that it won't happen, because now, can you imagine if they got rid of VAR every single time there was a decision that could have been rectified by the video ref? It will be, well, we need it back, we need it back. So I think they have got themselves into a horrendous position. I think they need to slow the whole process down again, even if it does take another 20, 30 seconds. Make sure, if you're going to do it, make sure you get the right decisions. I also don't understand why it's got to be these kind of former refs and the current refs that are doing VAR. You may, it's a new system, isn't it? Maybe that is for somebody else. Like, you don't need to have sort of reffed at the highest level, maybe, to do the VAR. Maybe that is a specific skill within itself that is slightly different to being an official on the pitch. Because clearly the ones that are doing it at the moment have got themselves into a right mess. I also don't think it helps how many of the former refs are now kind of selling themselves to every media outlet it sort of just adds this sort of, I suppose, fuel to the fire of them wanting to almost be the stars of the show now. Really, we shouldn't know the referee's name. That, you know, they should be an inconsequence on the sport. You know, you've seen and not heard and all of that. And, yeah, too many of them are just grabbing the headlines, rightly or wrongly. And I'm not sure that does them any favours. I don't think it does the game any favours either.
I completely agree with that. I mean, the goal line technology has been a revelation, and that works very well. I think the offside rule in general, drawing the lines, has been quite good. I think the technology that we used in the World Cup was even better. I think outside of that, Damien, it's so subjective, football as a sport, that sometimes when we're slowing down these decisions and seeing still images, it just ruins the game, and it ruins the flow of the game. And to Mark's point, it ruins the experience of being within the ground. You don't know if you can celebrate games or not. And for me, referees are far too involved in the game and have far too much inclusion within the game. We're hearing way too much from them.
Gentlemen, I think it's an issue that's going to roll and roll and roll, and we're not going to stop it, but I'm afraid miking up a referee that's running around and trying to keep up with a match, who's ever going to understand him or her? Anyway, I think we've got to take a quick break, Damien. 2FM.
I need a big flavour.
A what?
I mean a favour. Sorry, I think I need a wrap. I mean nap.
Sounds like someone has flavour on their brain. Get wrapped up in flavour with McDonald's Big Flavour Wraps. The barbecue and bacon chicken one. Today's €2.90 wrap of the day. From 11 a.m, wrap of the day discount not available on delivery orders. Price may vary, subject to availability.
Game on.
Rugby.
Welcome back to Game On. As you would expect on a Rugby World Cup week like this, the Ireland camp have been on media duty, and this afternoon it was the turn of defence coach Mike Catt to speak to the media, and he poured cold water on some of the theories that are out there.
I'm just focusing on our performance and the preparation of the players, obviously, but as a group of coaches, you know, Andy's fully aware of what's going and what needs to happen. You know, ultimately, from both sides, both teams need to win the game. You know, if you do that, then, you know, you put yourself in a good position. So, yeah, no, we're well aware. We understand what needs to be done. And again, if we put in a performance defensively and attack, you know, there's a chance that things will go our way, but it's going to be a proper test match, and that's why we play the game. History's history. It doesn't come into it at all from our point of view. We've prepared well for this game. We've had a weekend off on the back of that South Africa game, and we need to chase our potential. We need to make sure we go up another level to what we were against South Africa.
That's Mike Catt chatting earlier today. Delighted to say we're joined by former Scotland and Lions prop Peter Wright is with us. Hiya, Peter. Hello, Peter. We've lost Peter. We'll get Peter back there. It sounds like the LVAR check. We played it all over again. Ruby, realistically, there's not, like, I'm all in favour of Razzy Erasmus and his desire to stir these things up in advance of games, but surely there's not a hope in hell that the two teams would conspire to get the result they need to get South Africa out of the Rugby World Cup. Like, it's ludicrous.
That would be simply called match fixing.
Exactly.
Yeah, that is probably the biggest sin in sport, so I doubt that. I don't even know who dreamt it up, to be honest with you.
Razzy Erasmus.
Fair play to Razzy, but where do Ireland want to lose by 21 points? Yeah. Seeing as we were so into momentum was the only word I heard before the South African game. What do you want to do? Give it all away now against Scotland?
Yeah. I think Peter's back with us. Peter, how are you?
Hi there, guys. How are you doing?
Not too bad. We have you loud and clear. Listen, is there a single part of your being that thinks Andy Farrell and Gregor Townsend have been on the blower to each other this week, going, I'll tell you what now, Andy, you do this and we'll do that and the Springboks will be gone and the world will be a better... Like, listen, we're just saying there, I don't know if you could hear us, but, you know, poor El Razzy is sitting in the team hotel this week with nothing to do except spout theories that have no basis.
Yeah, I actually think it's quite disrespectful for the South African camp to even mention it. I would love that to happen personally. You know, I'd love to see South Africa knocked out. I'm not a massive South African fan, but I think to tar those Irish and Scottish players under management that potentially they'll fix the game, so is it South Africa? I mean, that's just typical South Africa, isn't it? They're so paranoid about everybody hating them in the world. It's what drives them on. It's what gives them success, that the fact that they believe they're the most hated team in the world, and that gives them so much drive to have success. But I was sad when I seen those comments. I just felt it's both sets of players, both managements will be disappointed. They'll be a bit, they'll be angry that's even came into anyone's thoughts, that teams would, you don't go into a game of rugby of this magnitude, with this physicality, with any other notion than to win the game. That is all you're there to do, and that's what Ireland want to do, and that's what Scotland will want to do.
So, Peter, if we've completely poured cold water on Razzie or Rasmus's theory, how does Gregor Townend get over your one? If you tell Scottish players six times they are no good, they will believe you, but you have to tell them a million times they are good to get the same result. How many times is Gregor Townsend going to have to tell them that to beat Ireland?
Well, he's already told them 999,999 times, so we're just about with that million time that we're going to... You know what? We have got the best team we've had for a long, long time. Probably one of the best attacking teams that we've ever had, that Scotland's ever had. So we do have the weapons, we do have the strikes, the strike players are back three, prolific try scorers, midfield, depending on who he picks. But with two Peloto and Finn Russell at 10 and 12, you've got two players that can really open up any defences. Our challenge is we create a lot of chances against Ireland over the years, but we haven't executed them. I can remember Stuart Hogg a couple of times, 2v1s, not giving the pass to score. We almost try and force it because we've not beaten Ireland for so long. We don't have that sort of, just that killer instinct against a team like Ireland. But you know what? The guys know that they've got a pretty much an instant reward if they get the right result. They're in the quarterfinals of the World Cup, and we aren't expected to be there. So I think it's going to be a cracking game, and I think we have a chance.
But ultimately, Peter, like a lot of the narrative here around the South Africa game was the fact that it was the one from the day the draw was done that everything was building towards. Can we say the same thing about the Ireland game from a Scotland perspective, that this effectively is the referendum this week on where this team has been over the course of the last 4 years?
Yeah, I would say so. I think last World Cup Scotland were really disappointing, losing to both Ireland and Japan. I think the fact that you guys beat South Africa has just made it that little bit harder. We were hoping, purely from a sporting point of view, that South Africa beat you guys, which meant that we just had to come in and win no matter what the score was. It was just a victory. Now, we could still beat the world number one team and not qualify. That's the scenario we're in. Ireland are, 16 unbeaten the last time. I think New Zealand were the last team to beat them with more than 8 points, which was what we have to do on Saturday. So there's so many things against us getting that result that'll take us through. But the boys believe, they're playing some good rugby, but we have just got to have every player playing the best game they've ever had. We've got to make sure our line out and our scrum function. But it sounds dead easy when you say it quickly, but when you're playing against the best team in the world and one of the best packs in the world and one of the best coaching teams in the world, it's going to be a tough ask, but not undoable.
Not undoable, but tricky. I mean, when do you go all out? When do you play completely off the cuff? I mean, you can't do it in the first minute because you could end up 7-0 down. When do you, in your own mind, envisage Scotland just taking the handcuffs off?
I think it'll be a very tactical game. I think they'll go with Chris Harris at 13. So they'll have Puopolotu and Harris 12 and 13, purely from a defensive point of view. Because we only have to win by 8 points, we don't have to go gung-ho to start with. But we've got to be strong in defence because Ireland only need 4 try bonus and that takes it away from us, really. So we've got to be, just patient. That's the key, patient. Get a platform. Get the guys, the forwards into the game, and try and disrupt the Irish pack where we can. I mean, the line out didn't go particularly well for Ireland in the South Africa game, and that's the sort of challenge we've got to do is make the throws tough, make the line out hard so they don't get that platform to attack from. But the flip side to that is Ireland are going to do exactly the same to us. So every single one of those forwards has to play the best game of their life, and I think it'll be cagey. I think there'll be a lot of kicking. I think Scotland will put the ball in behind Ireland a fair bit, try and find grass behind the sort of back three and really try and press high, try and force errors from the Irish team. Because, ultimately, Irish don't have to play as probably as much as the Scots do, but we've got to try and force them to, you know, play from a deep position, which, you know, even a team like Ireland, they're dangerous all over the park. They've got, you know, world class players everywhere. So, and I think, you know, speaking to one or two guys, I've had a chat with one or two of the guys just on the phone this week, and they're relishing the chance, they're relishing the challenge. They know it's a tough challenge, but they're really, really looking forward to it, which is good.
Peter, forgive me the sin of asking a prop what's happening out amongst the backs, but Ben Healy, what sort of an impact has he made for Scotland? Like, he's the highest profile player who could have played for Ireland, who's obviously decided to use the eligibility rules to go elsewhere. And we'd wish him well, and people at Munster would wish him well. Has he done enough to force Gregor Townsend's hand to make the 23 this week?
No, I don't think he had. He played against Romania the other night there, and he was scrappy. You know, he controlled the game to an extent, but he missed a couple of touch kicks. He dropped a couple of balls. I think he's almost trying too hard. You know, he's trying to get into Gregor's thoughts. I think Scotland might go 6-2. In the bench, I think they may try and, you know, Darge and Hamish Watson in the squad. They may go 6-2, and if they do that, then Healy probably no chance of being in the 23, because they'll use Blair Kinghorn as the cover for 10. Mm. But you know, he's a good player. I was always surprised that Ireland didn't cap him. We're really chuffed to have him. He's off an age where he can get a good few years out of him yet, and he'll come into a good player. A good international player, but it's maybe just a little bit early for him this World Cup.
Okay. Peter, enjoy the game at the weekend. May the best team win. Thanks so much for being with us.
Cheers, guys. Thanks.
Peter Wright with us there. Before we finish, Paul Curry is still with us. Ruby, they have torn up the VAR communication process, and apparently a new system of communication to be brought in.
Shock
in the
horror.
Premier League this weekend.
Shock horror, that is.
You know, will it make any difference?
I don't know, but they were under pressure, and I'm sure Howard Webb was wanting to tidy a couple of things up, so it's not too much of a surprise, is it?
Come on, how simple is it? So the fella sitting in the truck looks at the goal and then says to the referee, "That was offside, you may go back."
Yeah. They just need to calm down a bit.
I swear to God, it's rocket science now when you think about it, really simply and really clearly, rocket science.
Now listen, we better give you your time in 30 seconds.
We put Ruby in the truck next week.
Yeah, well listen, he's got loads of experience.
I'm used to being in a truck.
You know, it's the place for him. In 30 seconds, Chelsea are back.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're back. They were good last night, though. Probably similar to some of the performances we've seen in recent weeks. The only difference was that they managed to put two goals in the back of net. Mudrick getting a goal is very, very important. Clean sheet as well. It's something to build on. If they get another 3 points before the international break, that would be progress. But there's still a lot of eyes and still a questions on Chelsea.
Okay.
And Shinné for this evening. Damien O'Mara, that was a very quick hour. Thanks to Paul Curry and to Ronan Lawler. I do believe Betta De Silva's up next. I hope you all enjoyed our VAR chat.